We're never immune from disasters, natural or man-made, and Hawaii's isolation creates added challenges to any disaster response. This week, we've been breaking down and examining Hawaii's different areas of vulnerability. And in a disaster, much of the responsibility for keeping goods flowing among the islands would fall to Young Brothers, the Inter-Island Cargo Company, whose president and CEO, Joseph Boivin, is with us in our studio. Joe, thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Before we talk disaster, let's talk about what happens on a normal day. What kind of inter-island cargo traffic does Young Brothers have handle on any given day?
Well, on any given week, we handle about 12 shipments between islands.
Mm-hmm.
So regularly scheduled, we're regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, and largely responsible for providing the majority of capacity to move goods between islands.
Mm-hmm. So how long does it take for those goods, say a shipment to Hawaii, to need to be replenished?
Well, you know, over the past few decades, Hawaii has shifted from having a lot of storage on each island, where we tended to stockpile food and things like that, to one that is more just in time today.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes, what we deliver, say, to Niuili Willi or to Hilo in the morning, will be offloaded and brought to the stores and placed on the shelves that same afternoon. So that then drives a delivery schedule of every few days needing to bring in a vessel to provide enough food and enough goods to serve the island's needs.
So we actually have less stockpiled than we did, say, 20 years ago?
Yes.
What was the rationale for that, do you think?
Well, I think it had to do with streamlining operations to drive cost and increase profitability for all these businesses. When you store things like that, it costs money.
Makes sense.
And I think that was probably the primary driver.
But that does actually create increased vulnerability, doesn't it?
It can, because now you're operating on this just-in-time philosophy, and if there's any interruption in that logistics supply chain, you can run into problems.
The just-in-time philosophy sort of comes from the other end, the receiving end of the businesses you serve, is what it sounds like, that for their operations, it's more efficient for them to operate that way.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement.
But if something goes wrong, That's an added challenge, isn't it?
It can be, and it takes a lot of planning to run a logistics company like ours, week in and week out. If you think about the sheer volume of containers that are shipped between Honolulu and the neighbor islands, and then back again,
mm-hmm.
It's a lot of people, a lot of work, and it needs to run on a very regular schedule. Sometimes weather doesn't cooperate. We do have high winds, high seas. They can cause delays in trips, which is fairly common, and that includes delays in shipments coming from the mainland to Hawaii as well.
In a disaster, you obviously would not be responding in a vacuum, but whose help would you seek, let's say, if there were, well, let's take a real-world example, Hurricane Iniki. What happened in Hurricane Iniki when all kinds of access to the island was curtailed?
You know, in that case, back in 92, we were tracking the storms, as we do every day, tracking weather, understanding the impact of Hawaii. And that storm was tracking south of the islands and then went north unexpectedly. And when the storm hit, it did cause a tremendous amount of devastation, as we all know, on the island. In that case, the harbor was full of debris. And we had coordinated with the Army Corps of Engineers at that time to bring in equipment to help with the debris removal efforts. That took a few days, but then finally we were able to bring in a barge, and we provided 6 barges of humanitarian relief the first week after the storm. And that alone had its own challenges, because dropping off that much cargo at the port, even though it was needed, all of the roads weren't necessarily clear.
Mm-hmm.
All of the receiving companies weren't necessarily able to bring their employees, their equipment down to pick those containers up and bring them back to where they needed to be. So we had a large stockpile happening at the harbor itself. Now, ultimately, over time, that worked itself out. But that's another problem that you have. Just because you bring it to the island now you still need to distribute it mm-hmm. to the points of where it's needed, right? And so you need to make sure you have a very well-coordinated relief effort across the board. And that includes the Army Corps, local folks on the island, police, fire, and so forth, as well as the United States Coast Guard, state civil defense. So all of those entities come together, as well as the non-governmental organizations, because part of that humanitarian relief effort is to coordinate with the Foodlands and the KTAs of the world and others, the Red Cross, to bring in medical supplies, food supplies, and other supplies that are needed.
It's a reminder that any kind of disaster relief effort has to, coordination is sort of the very first job, almost.
It is, and I think today we have a pretty robust system in place in terms of processes and procedures. Mm-hmm. You know, when a storm is approaching Hawaii, we, as I'm sure many other companies such as Hawaiian Electric do, you stand up an incident command center. And this is really a group of people that are tracking the storm, that are thinking ahead about how to perhaps pre-position equipment that would need to be transported to a neighbor island, such as trucks to fix electric lines and things of that variety.
And you folks, Young Brothers, has such a system in place?
We do. We meet with Hawaiian Electric on an ongoing basis, and we coordinate with the NGOs throughout the year. So this is pretty well established for us in Hawaii.
Because when you were describing Naweliwili Harbor in Hurricane Iniki, the harbor had to be cleared of debris before any barges could come in. And that's always the problem in a disaster with harbors, because we were talking earlier and you reminded me that even the very nature of a harbor can shift in a disaster, making it inhospitable to ships coming in, right?
It can. You know, not only floating debris that needs to be cleared, but there could be damage to the pier side itself that mm-hmm. might prevent a ship from tying up. And there could be runoff from on-island streams or rivers that increase the depth of the ocean floor, mm-hmm. which then needs to be cleared. So there's a number of things that can happen. The Army Corps and the United States Coast Guard will address those issues and then work with the state harbors as well to make sure all of that is safe and clear.
Do you folks run scenarios, how do you describe it, do you game these scenarios in advance of what would happen if this harbor were closed, that harbor were closed?
We do. We call them tabletop exercises.
Uh-huh. And that's the term I was looking for.
Yeah. And which really just means that we will make pretend there's a storm coming. We'll get everybody involved with the process so that you are training and you know what your role, what your responsibility is, so that when something like this really happens, you are prepared. You know, it's the type of thing that if you don't practice and then it hits just once in a while, you may not be as prepared as you really need to be. And sometimes you have a very short window in which to react. Mm-hmm. You know, the tsunami warnings we had several years ago are a good example of that. Where you might have had 6 or 8 hours before this supposed tsunami was going to hit. And in Hawaii, we have a lot of equipment in the harbor areas that if left alone and not secured, you know, could be damaged. Mm-hmm. And that would further delay any sort of recovery effort. So one of the first things we do if we are going to get hit with something that would be, harmful to the equipment we have, is to move what we can out to sea and secure or relocate those assets that we do have in the harbors.
One of the things that happens in any kind of scenario like this that fascinates me is how specific you have to be about each person's role, right? Each member of the team is given very specific tasks in that kind of scenario. Kind of avoids confusion in a stressful situation, doesn't it?
It does. Everybody has a part to play in it, and you need to make sure that everybody knows what that part is.
Well, But to have a plan in place then, isn't it, Joe?
It is.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Joseph Boivin is president and CEO of Young Brothers, Hawaii's largest inter-island cargo carrier.
Hi, I am Kanwa from Jamarek. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple Store or Google Play.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, breaking through gender barriers in construction. But first, your quiz. It was doom and gloom for diehard American Idol fans when the music competition ended its 15-season run in April 2016. However, a year later, ABC picked up the rights to the series, and the rebooted version of the Goliath competition is back on the airwaves. For today's quiz, we delve into the American Idol archives to remind you of Hawaii's very own sweetheart, Jasmine Trias. The Mililani teen sang her way to the top three during the third season. She's fondly remembered for her beaming smile and a flower she wore over her right ear. This Marinol High School graduate began the competition with her rendition of Whitney Houston's Run to You and ended with a Universal Records deal. In 2005, Trias released a CD single entitled Flying Home, which was sold exclusively in Hawaii Pizza Hut and Taco Bell stores. But did you know she also recorded a promotional single for McDonald's in the Philippines? We want to know the title of that international collectible. You think you know? 941-3689 or call 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Each day I play the role of someone always in control. But at night I come home and turn the key. There's nobody there, no one cares for me.
Next time on The World, we're in drought-stricken Cape Town, South Africa.
Smile Water Report.
Here's Smile 90.4 FM's water reporter, Saya Pierce-Jones.
These days, when it comes to getting clean, I've started taking 10-minute long showers.
But she's using just 5 liters of water. How residents of Cape Town got obsessed with water-saving tricks and how that puts off a waterless future, at least for now. It's The World.
This afternoon at 1.
Some call them birds of paradise. They are construction tower cranes that dot the skyline when the construction industry booms. And it's a rare sight to have a woman in the cab anywhere in the country. There are 4 female crane operators in Hawaii in a predominantly male-dominated field. Pono Okamoto is one of them, a member of Operating Engineers No. 3. She's working her way up to break that glass ceiling and hopefully one day getting that bird's-eye view from a tower crane. She operates hydraulic mobile cranes now and is working up to lattice cranes. A self-proclaimed tomboy, she credits Ohaku Crane and Rigging for giving her a shot at a job after looking for a long time for a position that would be a good fit. Her lucky break with the union came with the rail project. Her current project is building a school at Schofield on Oahu's North Shore.
Tower cranes are the ones up in the air. The cab is off the ground. Once you're up there, you're on your own. Just it's all radio, you know, with the guys on the bottom. And, you know, Maybe one day I'll go down that path. I like the hydraulic cranes, though, that I run.
And so what's involved in that?
Everything from pre-trip to, you know, safety with your crew. Like, the initial crew I'm working with that day needs to know. They need to know what they're doing, what they have planned, and how we're going to do it as safely as possible. And then from there, we just, you know, rig whatever we have up. I lift, I put it down for them, take stuff up, take stuff down. Everything is usually in the air. Anytime you have a crane, it's because it's going off the ground, you know.
So how high up are you?
Me or the load?
Well, both. I mean, you know, because you're not a tower crane operator, but, you know,
I'm still
trying to understand
right,
how
I'm
that
still
works.
Above everybody on the ground, maybe about 20 feet at highest. With all my outriggers up, you know, and the load can be anywhere from 100 feet off the ground, you know, so.
But you've got to be able to watch. You've got a bird's eye view to some extent, but you've got to be able to know what's happening to make sure that everybody on the ground is safe.
Right, and we use, you know, audible signals, like using my horns or radio. And even if, like, nobody can hear, you're going to try wave them down, you know. I mean, everybody needs to be aware of the crane because it's above everybody's head. If anything falls or the, you know, anything that could cause a crane to flip, I mean, that's the worst, probably the most catastrophic accident on a job site. Nobody wants to deal with that, too, from the high-up bosses to the little people like us.
You know,
out in the field, yeah, like, nobody wants to get hurt. Everybody wants to go home to their family, and nobody wants to be the reason why somebody never come home to their family. So right. It's very important.
Right, yeah, safety first.
Safety first, yeah.
And so you maybe one day like to work your way up to be a tower crane operator.
Yeah, sure, you know. I mean, that seems very exhilarating, being up there. I know my uncle who works up there. I've got to see videos of him up there, and the views are just crazy, too. So that's
you're working
plus.
On it. You're working my way up.
You know, it's pretty similar, though. You know, if you could do that, you can do this.
It's just that you have higher to walk up to.
Your
office
is
on
way
a
higher
floor.
Some of them, too. Some towers are built short because maybe the building is only so high, so many stories high, and then some are just to the sky, you know. So it all depends on the job. Whatever the job is looking to build is going to determine what crane you're going to get for your job site.
So what type of cranes do you operate?
So mine is a hydraulic boom link belt. This is very common because it's mobile, so it makes it kind of convenient to move it around the job site and do the job. The boom is, it's not set. Like a lattice crane is set. So that's the height you're dealing with. And the only way to change it is to add a jib, which is an extension. The hydraulic booms are flexible in a job site. It can do many things from small jobs to big stuff. And it just goes up by weight after that.
So what types of projects have you worked on, or what are you working on now?
So we're building a school right now. Mainly the cafeteria is the big project there because you got to see this public school cafeteria. It's the biggest cafeteria I've ever seen for a public school. Elementary, and it's an elementary, so, I mean, it's like three stories high. It's pretty big.
And that's at Schofield.
And that's at Schofield, but it's a public school. So from my understanding, even if you don't live on Schofield, if you're in the district, your kid can still go there.
Brand new school. When's it supposed to get completed?
I think in 4 years, maybe a little bit less because it's moving pretty smoothly. After this section of the school is complete, when this is open, then they're going to knock down the other section and build that up. They're just doing it by section so the school can still be open to the kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so... Was it hard breaking into construction? Because it's really a male-dominated field. I don't know if you think the guys gave you a hard time, if you get razzing, or did you have, like, you know, some cousins at work and maybe kept an eye out on you?
No, I wish I had cousins out here. No, actually, everybody's really cool. I actually get along with guys very naturally, easily, because I have a lot of guy cousins. Just so happens none of them are in construction. But... it's like a flow. It's a natural flow. You know, there are some things, like being a female, like I will not use a portable. Not their portables.
Okay.
They are still men. Yeah, there's like lines I got to draw. I'm not very picky, but that portable is the one thing.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah, you know how it is. So.
And anything else, I mean, that you think, you know, you want to pass on to someone who might have an interest in getting into construction, into working cranes?
Well, what I've learned since being out here is the more flexible you can be, you know, trying to get out of your comfort zone, it makes your job a little easier. It makes other people's job easier, which makes you more appealing to work with, you know, and vice versa. You know, it's easier to work with people who's willing to try to get their job done safely. And, I mean, everybody's out there hot, thirsty, working hard, you know. And everybody just wants to go home and feed their families. But it is a cool trait. I mean, in all the trades, because I work with a lot of trades. I don't just work with operators. I work with carpenters, laborers, ironmen, masons, you know. I mean, so it's cool to see different trades and work with all types of personalities, you know. That's why I, as a crane operator, because you work with so many different, it's good to try to be as flexible and, you know, friendly.
Right. And so nobody in your family was in construction. You just decided, oh, I might give it a try.
I think I have a few family members on my dad's side who work construction, but I never did get the... I think they work Kobayashi, which is another pretty good company, but I never did work there. And I think they've been working there for a while. I just got into the construction industry about 4 years ago. Started outside of the union, which wasn't... it wasn't quite construction. It was... a wide range of jobs, anything from AC vents on the top of a building to, I even got the chance to work with Hawaii 5-0 when I was outside of the union. It was still crane operating, but, you know, I've had some good experiences in and out of the union.
Right,
so.
But you just didn't want an office job.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how. I like being outdoors, you know. It's fun. And... I know there's women out there. I've seen a couple women when I was working at Kiewit on the rail. I just never had the opportunity to work with them, like personally, because they're machine operators, which is another cool trait that I'm actually starting to slowly take on, you know.
Right. But it's just kind of just keeping your options open. And
Right.
You're just not afraid to try new things.
Yeah, right. You know, like I said, get out of that box, be flexible.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you're going places and hopefully go all the way up to the top.
Hopefully, yes.
Okimoto says most days when she wears her hard hat, safety glasses, and other protective gear, you might not know she's a woman on the job. The only giveaway may be the glitter and paint on her nails. She does appreciate a nice manicure. This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz.
Aloha, this is Joey Manahan. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Musical chairs for a familiar face, a different political party, and maybe a different office. Chad Blair joins us this morning with a story about Beth Fukumoto. Morning, Chad.
Hi, Catherine.
So interesting that she's throwing her hat out in the ring here.
Right, so she's a state representative, and of course, she made national headlines, gosh, it was just over a year ago, when she criticized President Trump. Now, why is that so unusual? Well, at the time, she was a Republican. She was the minority leader, in fact, in the state House of Representatives, and she very publicly, very vocally denounced the president's, in her view, views towards women and minorities. Racist and sexist is really the way that she described the president. And that led to her getting a lot of attention, but it also led to her losing her position in the minority party. And subsequently, she actually left the Republican Party. She is now running as a Democrat, her first ever time as a Democrat on the ballot, and she's running for Congress.
So do you think she's going to feel any backlash? What's your sense?
Oh, gosh. There's certainly people in the Republican Party that called her a traitor, called her a fake when she left the party, switched parties. There are some probably in the Democratic Party saying, look, are you really a Democrat? But she did pass the test. She was accepted into the party. It's hard to say how people will vote. But remember, in the primary race, you know, you can actually pick up any of the ballots. You have to pick one, Democrat or Republican or nonpartisan or green. But if you are a Republican, you could vote Democrat and vice versa. So it is possible that people that maybe support her views against President Trump might actually say, look, I'm going to vote for this person because I'd like to send them to D.C. to represent us.
But she's got some pretty stiff competition in that field, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. State Senator Donna Kim, Lieutenant Governor Doug Chin, formerly the Attorney General, State Representative Kaniella Ng, and Ernie Martin, the council chair here on Oahu. So those are pretty well-known names. A recent poll, however, Star Advertiser earlier this week, stated exactly that nearly a third of the vote is undecided of the people that they surveyed. That's a lot of people up for grabs. Neither of the two frontrunners, Chin or Kim, really had more than 30% or so. So having Fukumoto jump in, it suggests the race is still wide open. And who knows? There's still time for another candidate or two to jump into that race as well.
Well, now, Doug Chin certainly made the headlines with the lawsuits against the Trump administration. But for the most part, Kaniella Ng and Beth are newcomers to the political scene.
Yes, they are. They're millennials. They're people in there. And I don't want to get the exact age right. But I think Beth Fukumoto turns 35 tomorrow. Ng must be late 20s, early 30s. Forgive me if I have the date wrong. Donna Kim, an experienced veteran. She's in her 60s. Doug Chin, I think mid 40s. There is a generational thing going on. And I think that's something that particularly with you see in the Me Too movement and the right to march over the gun violence and the women's movement. There's a lot of things going on right now. So these youngsters think this is their time.
Well, there are folks who say, well, the strategy is to just get your name out while you're young so that people get to know you if you have your sights set of, you know, seriously for another office down the road.
Exactly. I didn't mention Ernie Martin. You know, he may well be looking to run for Honolulu mayor. He's actually term limited, and that office should be up in 2 years' time or less. So that is one thing happens when you run for Congress. Your name is in the press a lot. You're on TV, you're in the newspapers, you're online, and you can get circulated. And if you don't win this race, maybe you've got your brand name out there for another race down the line.
Right. And, you know, I recall years ago, decades ago, when we had the recall of the Honolulu City Council members who switched parties. And I think,
sure.
You know, eventually I think that led to nonpartisan races there over at the city. But that was certainly a shock for visitors. I mean, for residents in the whole election process.
Right. And it is important to note that the county races are all nonpartisan throughout the state, not so with the legislature, not so with federal races. So we will see. There's other parties running, too, by the way, Green, Libertarian. No Republican so far has pulled papers to run for the first congressional seat representing urban Oahu. Not yet, anyway.
Okay. Well, we'll have to watch that one. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Sure.
That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
All this week we've been talking about Hawaii's vulnerabilities, and we heard you on our talkback line following yesterday's segment with Chris Crabtree about Hawaii's health care systems.
Hi, this is Susan Hartman Fukumoto, RN, from Kauai. I'm commenting on the Hawaii Emergency Management Health Team. I was listening, and I had a suggestion that that director contact Wilcox Hospital on Kauai and our Department of Health, also the Director of Public Health in the state. We had a immediate emergency in Iniki, and then long-term emergencies at our hospital, the only operating hospital on Kauai. Had no running water and no electricity for weeks, months, and we had to figure out what to do in real time, and disaster plans had to be adjusted. Thank you.
After last week's segment on opioids, Lori in Waipahu called.
Everyone has been covering this opioid crisis, as they call it. I mean, it's this big kerfluffle, and it only became such, by the way, when everybody started dying from it, meaning not just black kids in the hood, but, you know, white kids. Anyway, I'm calm because I worked hard all my life, raised three kids, worked two jobs, sometimes three jobs. I'm a retired physical therapist. I really try to take care of myself. I try to do things properly, stay strong, stay active, participate in the community, try to be a decent person. But my back, it turns out, I don't think it was a congenital defect, but something happened to where I had a spinal lordosis, is the technical term, but it was a huge problem. My back was unstable. I've rebuilt my strength, I think, quite well, but I still have pain in different areas. And also, I did become addicted. I mean, I know that. I think I have kind of I'm kind of a cross, you know, like I need pain medication, opioid medication, if you will. A good part for pain, and also partly because my brain just is, I don't know, something changed when I started taking it. And when I don't take it, I just don't function well.
We thank you for your thoughts, and you can always tell us what's on your mind by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or by emailing us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Musicians love to shrug off our need for sleep.
We will never sleep, cause sleep is for the weak.
That rap, I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death.
You don't need sleep. That was the thinking back in the 60s, and that's the thinking that I had.
Meet the man who went 11 days without sleep this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
Each generation is more media savvy than the last, and today's high school students are growing up in a world where an understanding of all forms of communications media, be it radio, television, online media, or print, is essential. Lei Awohi is a teacher at Kauai High School whose specialty is media literacy and whose methods are hands-on. She's one of 30 educators from across the country selected for the first PBS Digital Innovator All-Star program. I asked her to describe media literacy and outline its importance.
A way to define it might be to, you know, help students understand the role of media in society today.
Mm-hmm.
And as up-and-coming broadcasters or news journalists, you know, what their role is in terms of representing news in a responsible manner.
Mm-hmm. The very thing that a lot of people are lamenting the loss of,
right,
in today's society.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. Last year, and it kind of carried over into this year, four of my senior girls had produced a piece that was titled The Fact of You. And it was addressing just that, you know, actually being true to yourselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, and representing, or actually, you know, having your actions represent the kind of person you want to be, you want to be known as, and, you know, not succumbing to pressures of the community or peer pressure, but, you know, just being you and being true to who you are.
You know, one of the things that we're in a sort of a national moment, Leah, in the wake of the Parkland shooting, of looking at high school kids as generators of ideas rather than receptors of ideas.
Oh, that's so true. And, you know, they have a very powerful voice. You know, it's an exciting time, I think, for the youth of today. You know, they have strength in the words that they have to share. And while speaking for my students, you know, they're very mature, wise beyond their years.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. And I'm optimistic in thinking that we'll be in good hands with them. You know, they have good ideas. They have strong convictions about what they feel should be going around them. And they're not afraid to verbalize.
Have they lost some faith in institutions?
I don't think so. You know, and that's what I admire about them. You know, there's still hope, I see. And when I see that they're mature in the sense that, you know, they can discern really well, I guess, what's legitimate, what's not legitimate, you know. And I teach at a high school, so I'm talking about high school students.
Right.
You know, I see them as being influencers for those students that come after them, too. And, you know, just the way they carry themselves, they're not easily influenced by just anything that they hear in the news or magazines or whatever they might come across. But they're very discerning in terms of, you know, filtering information that they come across.
We hear an awful lot about youth culture in terms of some negative aspects, right? Bullying, drug use, you know, all kinds of the kind of irresponsible behavior that comes with being 16 years old in, to some degrees. How does a teacher address that? And none of us are entirely immune, right?
Oh, that's true. And, you know, it's so sad to see how widespread these kind of problems are. And while in my role as a teacher, I think being a media teacher especially, you know, we have that opportunity to get messages out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's through venues like PBS Hawaii's Hiki No program. We also participate in the News Hour as a student reporting lab, and we contribute to Olelo Community Television's youth exchange video
mm-hmm.
contest.
Mm-hmm.
And so our students kind of construct their messages, you know, a lot around the issues of today and what they have to deal with in terms of bullying, substance abuse, you know.
One of the things about those programs, Leah, mm-hmm. is that nobody gives them subject matter, right?
No.
They originate the subject matter, so
correct.
You can kind of find out what's on their mind, can't
oh,
you?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, I learn a lot, you know, in the brainstorming phase of just, you know, building their vision for what the message is that they're going to communicate. You know, I always start off with having the students do research, and they share out with the class about what they found or what they've known, or what they'd like to explore more to share a message out about. And I'm always learning from what they have to share. They surprise me all the time.
You know, looking back to my long ago school experiences, those times when you kind of got into a collective project, you got a little bit out of the classroom, did a field trip, they were the things that we looked forward to, and they were fairly rare in those days. But that's kind of when everybody gets involved, isn't it?
It is. And I think I'm fortunate in the sense that just about all the classes that I teach are, you know, it's real life. It's engaging the students in actual community issues, community events. It's breaking down the four walls of the classroom and actually having life be the classroom for the students.
You know, I was sort of thinking of the things that characterize effective teaching. Part of it, I would think, would be what you get back from the students, responding to what comes from the students. Is that at all accurate?
I think it's right on. You just hit it on. You hit the nail on the head. I mean, the
learning from them.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah. I learn every day from them, and you know, it's rewarding. No day is the same. I mean, and every year is different. You know, even after the number of years that I've been teaching in the public school system, I'm still excited to go to work every day. It's, you know, I find it fulfilling. And it's because of the students that I have. And, you know, their joy in learning and wanting to learn.
That has to come to some degree from your joy, right? You know, it's a, you're completing a cycle there.
I guess it's a healthy synergy, yeah.
You're sending it out.
And getting back in return, and it just kind of feeds upon each other. I guess so.
Leia Awahi is a teacher at Kauai High School. She's one of 30 educators from across the country selected for the first PBS Digital Innovator All-Star Program. She's a 28-year veteran of Hawaii's public schools.
Violence in video games is, again, getting a lot of attention given real-world problems.
When I see the fact that we have to keep explaining and re-explaining what we do and what our craft means and all these kind of different issues, that's us not doing a good enough job at helping reach out to the public.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How far is too far with video games? Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
Earlier in the show, we reminded you about Mililani's songbird, Jasmine Trias. Before she rose to national fame on season 3 of American Idol, she won the Brown Bags to Stardom state singing competition in 2001 and the Road to Fame 2003 youth talent competition. Known for her sweet smile and the island flower over her ear, Jasmine entered the television competition singing Whitney Houston's Run to You. Her talent and charisma carried her all the way through to the semifinals when she went against top contenders Fantasia Barrino and Diana DeGiarmo for a shot at the title. Although Jasmine did not win American Idol, she did go on to graduate from Mary Knoll High School and is considered a superstar in Asia. In 2004, McDonald's in the Philippines carried the Jasmine Trio special on its menu. It included a strawberry float, yard fries, and her CD signal, Love Koto.
And the winner of that quiz is from St. Louis Heights, Natalie Moreland. Got it right. Congratulations to you, Natalie. That is the answer to today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Here I am.
Call them anything but underachievers. One has tackled Mount Everest Base Camp, another is an ultramarathoner, and the list goes on. You may have heard that earlier this week, a dozen women set out to break a world record with, of all things, a kettlebell. We were out at Ala Moana Park this week as the group, part of a fitness ohana, worked to get into the Guinness Book of World Records. Their goal was 63,000 pounds of weight lifted over the course of 60 minutes. It wasn't a fitness goal when these women started. They are between 50 to 76 years old and just wanted to stay healthy and strong. They were inspired by their coach, Johnny Sarich, who's from Canada. He holds a world record for hauling a wheelbarrow loaded with more than 8,000 pounds of bricks, some 243 feet. Under the guidance of Sarich and team leader Brenda Wong Im, this attempt to set a new record became a new fitness challenge.
10 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and.
My name is Dottie Sunil. I am a computer teacher at Leeward Community College. And the toughest thing I've done is a half Ironman in Kona called Honu. But I've done over 40 triathlons, swimming, biking, running, and I do. I've been doing kettlebell for about 7 to 8 years.
My name is Judith Inasu. 69 years old. I've been running for
almost 50, no, 30-something years, and I've done almost 50 marathons. My hardest was the Haleakala Run to the Sun, which I've done 2 times, and that was like 36 miles up the volcano.
My name's Lori McCarney, and the toughest thing I've ever done is the Ironman World Championship, but this runs right up there with something that's making me nervous right now about actually being able to do this. I'm very excited.
So tell me, what's the toughest thing you've done?
The toughest thing I've ever done is hiking to the Mount Everest base camp and then hiking one mountain above it, which would be close to 19,000 feet.
And so this record today?
This is very exciting because it's a team effort.
Your name?
Denby Fawcett.
You ladies like a challenge.
We do like a challenge, especially when I remember as each member came on board, where they were, the people with double knee replacement, the people with a hip problem, the people with a spine problem, the people who are just kind of injured. But by coming regularly and having fun exercising, I saw how, when I look at pictures, how their bodies transform because we're having fun exercising regularly.
Now, what's the hardest physical thing that you've done prior to this?
The hardest one was a Hurt 100. It's a 100-mile ultra marathon. But when you think of it, it's relative to what you choose to do. You train for it, you prepare for it, and that hard is the same hard as a little thing. It might be a short race, a 10K race, a 3K race, a 100-mile race. It's hard because it takes a lot of time.
And with this, now, describe how difficult making sure you follow all the rules in order to make this a bona fide record.
The hard thing about applying for this Guinness attempt is contacting the organization. When you submit an inquiry, it takes like weeks. Maybe it was like 12 weeks. Maybe it was like, not maybe, it was like 3 months before we figured we want to do this. And you don't get a response and you're waiting and waiting. And it's not like a phone call you can do. Maybe that was harder than training for this thing, is to get everything set up. And then finally you get the paperwork and it's pages of regulations of what's gonna pass to make it authentic for breaking a world record. However, there's some like questionable requirements. Like, what do you mean by parallel to the ground on the arm swing? What do you mean? Can your elbow be bent? Is your arm straight? There are different techniques of kettlebell swing.
Now, I understand you had to have special judges, certified judges. You had to make sure that these kettlebells were weighed,
yes,
and certified. Yes. No cheating here.
No cheating. And so all of that has to be videoed. So we have 2 certified judges. They carry license, active license. We have 2 timers. We have someone is videoing the weigh-in, and it's a certified weigh, like a weight organization. And then we submit all of that again. So Guinness reserves the right, although we have the experts who are going to count our swings, going to measure the weight, Guinness will review it again.
Was this your idea to get these women going?
I wanted to give the girls some type of a recognition for the efforts that they're doing and the work they're doing. Some of the stuff they figured they could never do, and they accomplished it through training and exercising and finally deciding, yes, we can do it.
And so for one straight hour with 30 tons of kettlebells flying, Johnny's Fitness Ohana swung their hearts out. Hana ho. And now they wait. And it may not be until the summer before they get the official word about whether they will get in at Guinness Book of World Records.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
But a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, we have an opportunity to learn positive communication skills.
Yes, that's happening tomorrow in Kailua Kona. This workshop is led by Andrea Pro. She's a certified nonviolent communication expert, and she'll focus on developing skills for strong foundations and cooperation, even in challenging relationships. And you'll also learn to recognize and deal with emotional triggers and build connection. This sounds pretty good.
It does, yeah. Especially the nonviolent part.
Right, right. It's happening tomorrow at 5:30 at Hawaii Community College's Palamanui campus in Kailua Kona, and it's free.
And then on Friday and Saturday, two local performers will give a cabaret concert, an intimate concert in the arts at Mark's Garage.
Yes, Ruth Ashiroma Foster and Becky McGarvey, maybe you know them. Of them are teaming
maybe
up for the, yeah, for the Love Cafe, an interactive variety show with live music, singing, and dancing, including tap. Ruth and Becky will sing classic jazz standards from the 1930s and 40s. The Love Cafe is tomorrow and Saturday in the Arts at Mark's Garage. Doors open at 6, and the show begins at 7 on both days. You can get your tickets on our website.
And there's a party on Lanai tomorrow night.
The Lanai Chamber of Commerce invites everyone to its next Fifth Friday tomorrow from 5:30 to 8 p.m. The free event features live music, food and drinks, a free grand drawing prize, and more. It takes place in the heart of Lanai City. That's around Dole Park tomorrow night, 5:30 to 8 p.m.
Just go to where all the cars are parked, right?
That's right.
Easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today, and up tomorrow we'll continue our look at Hawaii's vulnerabilities and talk Hawaii wildfire management with Clay Traurnik, fire specialist with the University of Hawaii Cooperative Extension Service.
And tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
You can always find us under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow as we continue the conversation.
Well, no. I missed